Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I hope the holidays are treating you well so far, and I wanted to share with you a little Christmas story of our own. From the New Yorker's Daily Shouts, here's Kathleen Turner in Children's Holiday Letters to Satan.
Dear Satan, what I really want this year more than anything is a Barbie dream house. It's pretty and pink, and I will keep it in my room near my bed. Merry Christmas, Allison, age 6.
Allison. Huh. I see what you've done here. You intended for your letter to go to Santa, but due to your poor grasp of spelling, it has instead come to me. It really should go without saying, but I will not be getting you this so-called dream house because I do not want to. But I will suggest this. Buy it yourself. Simply take $2 from your mom's wallet every day, and soon enough, you'll have your useless and silly miniature house. Regards, Satan.
Dear Satan, I am Daniel and I love you. I want an Xbox for Christmas. Daniel, age 9.
Dear Daniel, am I getting your name right? You only mentioned it twice in your 10-word letter. I've wasted 5 minutes of my life Googling this Xbox, and I suppose I'm left with one question. Why? This game, Grand Theft Auto, indeed seems quite fun, but why waste your day sitting in front of the TV when there are so many actual cars to be stolen? Damn it, Daniel! Get out there and live! Your friend, Satan.
Dear Satan, I just want my mom and dad to get back together. Stephanie, age 11.
Stephanie, you're over 10. Stop telling people your age. It's childish. As for your mommy and daddy, maybe it's my own but it feels as if you're blaming me for their separation. While I did put Vicky from accounting in front of your father to tempt him, I didn't make up your father's unconvincing lie about working late. But I feel bad. I'm going to send you something called an Xbox. Best, Satan.
Dear Satan, I want a computer so I could do better in school and get a good job and make lots and lots of money. Thrum, David.
Dear David, being the embodiment of pure evil, I will not get you this computer. I'm not Mark Zuckerberg. Or am I? Kidding, I'm not. But if you really want a job that allows you to make a great deal of money fast, you can go ahead and send me your resume. I have a number of very close friends at Goldman Sachs. Regards, Satan.
Dear Satan, all I want for Christmas is world peace. Brian, age 4.
Dear Brian, no.
That's Children's Holiday Letters to Satan by Matt Passett, who's also a producer for John Oliver's Last Week Tonight, performed for us by the inimitable Kathleen Turner. Whatever else 2018 may bring us, one change is certain. On January 1st, the New York Times will be getting a new publisher. Now, you might not think of the New York Times as a family business, but it is. In 1896, Adolph Oakes bought the paper in a bankruptcy sale, and since then, The business side of running the Times has been overseen by five generations of his descendants. The current publisher is Arthur Oak Sulzberger, Jr., who announced this year that he would pass the baton to his son, Arthur Greg Sulzberger, who goes by A.G. A.G. is young for the job. He's 37. But he's about to take over leadership of one of the world's greatest news institutions at an extremely complicated time for journalism, which is an understatement, if anything. I sat down with A.G. Sulzberger last week. I should begin by congratulating you. Do you feel like you should be congratulated, or you feel like you should be given a cool glass of water?
Well, thank you. It's definitely an honor and a privilege and a daunting one. Maybe the best note I got from a colleague was congratulations/sorry, which I think is probably a statement of, you know, the pretty profound challenges facing journalism in this moment.
They're pretty profound. And we'll get to all of that. I have to start by saying that I've had my whole career has been in competition with and in admiration of the New York Times, a bit with the Washington Post and the New Yorker. And at the Washington Post, Donald Graham was the publisher, and he was essentially raised to be the publisher. I mean, he worked as a policeman in Washington, D.C. to get to know the city. He was a sports editor. He had all kinds of jobs that were, in a sense, to train him for this future. Did you always know as a kid that this was the likely future for you?
I've always had a theory that decent journalists are contrarians. And like any decent journalist, I have a contrarian streak. And I actually spent most of my life not thinking I would go into journalism.
But you grew up with this inheritance of the Sulzberger family and the New York Times, which is, I think, in to my mind, maybe the most important private institution there is in this country and civic institution.
Well, thanks for saying that.
Oh, well, I believe it. How could you picture yourself outside of it? Was that really open to you?
Yeah. I mean, look, my parents and the broader Sulzberger family, you know, has always encouraged people to chart their own course. For me, it changed in college. I took a class with a professor who was a full-time investigative reporter at the Providence Journal. Her name is Tracy Breton. Won a Pulitzer Prize for the journal, has a bullet in her leg from one of the stories, just like a great investigative reporter. And I found I just loved that type of writing.
So you got the bug from her?
Well, so I end up doing two classes with her, the first semester and the second semester. And at the end of it, we had this moment. And the conversation basically, you know, went like this. Arthur, I've got a job for you at the Providence Journal. And I said, you know, Tracy, I've always been a little ambivalent about following such a predictable route. And I think I'm going to start my career trying some other things. And, you know, she looked at me and she said, Arthur, I can just tell that you're going to love this. And I think if you don't try it, you'll always wonder. And, you know, well, the first 3 months on any new beat are terrifying.
What was your beat?
Well, I covered a small town called Narragansett. And I was a town reporter. I covered town council meetings. I covered school board meetings. Every morning I'd call the police chief, what happened overnight. And, you know, those jobs have disappeared. And it's a tragedy because it's the single best way to come up in our profession.
Smaller newspapers, regional newspapers.
Yeah.
It seems to me your apprenticeship was not merely as a reporter in various bureaus, but maybe the most important phase of that apprenticeship was working on something that became known as the Innovation Report that was either leaked or creatively leaked in the midst of a crisis. Tell me a little bit about that.
And by creatively leaked?
I don't know. It somehow arrived in the world. How did that happen?
Yeah. So I'd been an editor on Metro for a couple of years, and Jill Abramson, who was then the editor of the Times, approached me and said she wanted me to lead a small group that would be charged with coming up with a new product idea. So I pulled together a team of smart people from around the newsroom, and I did, you know, what I know how to do as a reporter, which is I just talked to a bunch of people inside and outside the building, and it pointed me to a clear spot, which is the New York Times wasn't lacking for good ideas about new products. What it was lacking was a full embrace that we were becoming a digital media company, and that that would force us to really rethink a lot of what we were doing. So I wrote a 100-page memo, printed 8 copies, very discreetly delivered them to a small number of newsroom leaders. And you can only imagine my surprise when several weeks later it was printed in full on BuzzFeed.
To all of our benefit elsewhere, by the way. I learned a tremendous amount from it. But when I say creatively leaked, I mean that somebody was not happy with the report. You know, there was politics involved. What was the sense of conflict over this report?
Look, it was a controversial document at the time. And I think it was read outside the building as the New York Times trying to understand what it wasn't doing right as the world was changing around it. And I know that there were people who were unhappy with that notion. I mean, you know, one of the things that makes an institution like the New York Times or the New Yorker or the Washington Post successful is these traditions that have been passed down through generations and these really old-fashioned public-oriented notions about service and about truth and about fairness. And when journalists who feel those things strongly see change, I think it's inevitable to worry that some of those special things could be at risk.
Was the conflict along generational and age lines?
Not exclusively, but it probably trended that way. But the leak of it, I have to say, was the most productive thing that happened in the evolution of the Times. And I'll never forget—
Because it forced the conversation?
It didn't just force the conversation. You know, there's this phrase in journalism, show, don't tell.
Yeah.
And I think leaders of news organizations for many years had been telling people to change. You know, you got to file faster because the web is fast. You have to go on social media because that's where the conversation is. You have to change how you tell stories because we have all these new storytelling tools and the internet's more visual. But we weren't arming our colleagues with this sort of shared sense of reality. Like, where are we? What are the forces we're facing? And there were some really tough findings in there and tough statistics, you know.
What do you think was the toughest thing for people to bear, the statistically or in terms of just the facts of the matter?
I think at the time it was really tough to realize that a whole bunch of digital players like the Huffington Post and BuzzFeed had rapidly eclipsed us in reach. I'm not sure people had fully engaged with how dramatically the way that people were finding and engaging with journalism had changed. A Pulitzer Prize winner, actually a 3-time Pulitzer Prize winner, David Barstow, pulled me aside that day. And, you know, on paper, he would seem like the type of, you know, sort of old-fashioned journalist, you know, that may feel threatened by a document like this. And instead, he pulled me aside and said, I get it now.
You're now in your late 30s. At what point do you expect that the print New York Times will be either completely gone or just a kind of, you know, something that very special readers read in tiny numbers?
Yeah, I'm always amazed at how often this question comes up. I think it's a testament.
Do you think it's really important at all?
Well, I think it's a testament to how much people love the print New York Times, that this is this enduring concern. What I will say is that we've got 1 million loyal readers. The paper is profitable every day of the week, even without a single advertisement.
But I expect it to be
around for a long time.
For a long time is what we always say, and I say when I'm asked the same question because I want to fudge it too. But does it matter to you in terms of the experience of reading the Times? I'm now at the point where I read both. A lot of the sensation when I read the paper is, wait a minute, I read this 2 days ago. More and more and more of these things that I've read 2 days ago. And then I have the other frustration, maybe some people agree with me. The one thing reading on the phone doesn't do as well is surface more things. It's very hard on a device that's the size of a kind of a index card to surface as many things as efficiently as turning the pages of a broadsheet newspaper. So that's a big challenge, isn't it?
For serendipity, and if you're a completist, nothing beats print. But you look at the type of storytelling we're doing on the phone, or on the desktop right now or in podcasts. And it is qualitatively better experiences that we are creating, things that you could not do, you know, in ink and paper.
Has Donald Trump, in a sense, helped you? Did you got a Trump bump like the rest of us?
Yeah, the Trump bump, for your listeners, is the surge in subscriptions that many news organizations experienced right after the election. We started to see this growth even before the election, and I actually attribute it to a couple of things. I mean, one, we've gotten much better as a digital news organization. I think our product, our journalism is drawing people in a new way. Two, I think that we're seeing a real shift in people's willingness to pay for services online. It's not a coincidence that before the election, we were having our best subscription quarters the same times that both Spotify and Netflix were having their best subscription quarters. And then I think three, and this is the tough one. This is the one that I think all of us who care about journalism and care about this country should really be worrying about. I think we've been seeing growth because the rest of the media ecosystem is getting so weak.
You used to have, until very recently, a public editor who was the kind of in-house critiquer of whatever he or she wanted to critique. It was probably not the fastest way to become a popular person in any newsroom, but it was a role that was in the New York Times for quite a long time. You've decided to get rid of that. Why?
It felt like a vestige of print. I mean, one of my jobs is to look at all the things that we're doing that made total sense in an era when the news came once a day, or if you're a Sunday subscriber, once a week, and don't make sense in a world in which you don't have a passive, removed audience. And I think it felt like, in some ways, we were disintermediating?
I think disintermediating works.
Is that right? Okay, disintermediating accountability and asking a single person to call us out if we did something wrong. And I actually think that there's a much better model, which is the reporters and editors stepping forward in those moments and responding to readers and saying, this didn't work. And there's a great example of this. We had a pretty lousy story about a year ago about what would all the dads do in Montclair when all the moms went to the Women's March.
Ouch.
And it was, you know, in the old system, we would have waited a week for the public editor to decide whether or not she would weigh in.
Yeah.
You know, the editor and reporter in question probably would have crossed their fingers and hoped that she deemed that it wasn't bad, even though all of social media has decided, no, this is a very bad story. In this scenario, what actually happened was the Metro editor, within hours, went public and said, hey, I really messed up here. This was a terrible story, and please don't blame it on our reporter. It was a bad assignment that he was given. And I think that is just a much more responsive model that fits much better with the moment.
I just saw the movie The Post, and I hope this doesn't hurt. But this is about the Washington Post's experience vis-a-vis the Pentagon Papers, the new Steven Spielberg movie. Now, the Times is given kind of credit for breaking the story, which they did in the beginning. But I'm told people at the New York Times are really annoyed with this movie.
Oh, I wouldn't say really, really annoyed. What I would say
I mean super annoyed at this movie.
I think we're all looking forward to the next Watergate movie, focusing on the extraordinary reporting of the New York Times.
That's fair.
A.G. Sulzberger, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Arthur Greg Sulzberger will take over as publisher of the New York Times on January 1st. Ahead this hour, my conversation with one of the great voices in songwriting, the late Leonard Cohen. Stick around.
Greetings, dear friends. Welcome to my 2017 holiday newsletter.
I'm David Remnick, and you're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. And now a few words from Tony Hale.
Whether you light the menorah or deck the halls with boughs of holly, we can all agree that the most beautiful thing about this season is the chance to catch up with the most treasured people in our lives. And for me, that's you. And boy, am I lucky to have such observant friends. Several of you were in touch after my holiday newsletter last year, which I will admit may have contained a few misstatements. I'm in a much better place this holiday season, and I am determined to set the record straight now. Okay? All right, let's do this. Number one, while I am a potential organ donor, you can check my driver's license on that one, I was getting a little ahead of myself when I implied that my kidney had already saved the life of a little girl named Samantha. I apologize about that. Number two, while it may have been a stretch to say that I'd volunteered to tutor children at the local elementary school, I did once volunteer to give a volunteer a ride to the school. Twice. I did that twice, actually. Yep. All right, number three. When I said that my big new passion is the saxophone, I'm afraid I may have given some people the impression that I had been playing one. Number four, yes, I did quit drinking cold turkey. Bam. But it was not, in fact, owing to the strength of my willpower alone. The police monitored attendance at the 12-step meetings deserved a lot more credit than I gave them. So thank you, boys. Number five. Whew, this one's close to home. Unfortunately, I was not able to honor my father's request to have his ashes scattered over Loon Lake, where he fished all of his life. But boy, did I ever come up with a unique plan B involving an unlocked minnow tank at his favorite live bait establishment. Woo! Dear friends, I feel so much better now. It is nice knowing that this year's holiday greeting is really worth the paper it's printed on, which the old me would have said was 100% recycled, and that would have not been true. Best wishes to one and all in the new year. Sincerely, Bill. You're welcome, Dad. Miss you.
Corrections to my Christmas newsletter by Bill Franzen. It appeared in the New Yorker's Shouts and Murmurs page and was performed by Tony Hale, who you might recognize from Veep and Arrested Development. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Like a bird on the wire, like a drunken midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free.
Last year, I spent a few days with the songwriter Leonard Cohen. Cohen had been avoiding interviews for the past 4, 5, 6 years, but once he agreed to talk, we talked for days and covered the length and breadth of his career. And I'm grateful that I had the chance to visit when I did, because not long after, Leonard Cohen died at the age of 82. Cohen once wrote a song called The Tower of Song, in which he compared himself really unfavorably to Hank Williams. But along with the other masters, Bob Dylan certainly, Joni Mitchell, Kanye West, everybody's got their own list, Leonard Cohen is way up there in the ranks of songwriters. When I visited him in Los Angeles, he was suffering from a number of very serious illnesses, although he was keeping that very, very private. He was in deep pain, especially from compression fractures in his spine, and he had to sit in a big blue medical chair. He was very thin, maybe 110 pounds at the most. But I have to say that he was in an ebullient mood somehow for a man who knew where life was taking him, and it was going to take him there in a hurry. He was the most gracious host this side of my mother.
Would you like a few slices of cheese and olives?
No, I'm good, thank you.
You're cool?
Cohen had just finished up a new album called You Want It Darker, He'd recorded almost all of it sitting in that medical chair right there in the living room, a really modest space with just a couple of guitars, some recording equipment, and a keyboard. And even as our talk, like the album itself, never really strayed far from the end of things, his sense of humor, his vicious self-mockery, was always present.
Sorry, darling.
No worries.
Could you bring my hearing aid?
Yes, of course.
I can't hear a all.
Cohen grew up in Montreal in a prominent Jewish family, a well-to-do, established family there. His family ran a clothing concern, and it was almost as an homage to his family business that Cohen, even in the 60s, always wore beautiful, well-cut suits, including a tailored dark blue number that he had on when I saw him. When Leonard was 9 years old, his father died, and that event became a kind of origin story for his career as a writer, and as someone who believed in writing as an almost sacramental act.
My father's funeral was held in our house. We came down the stairs, the coffin was in the living room, and it was open. It was winter, you know, and I was thinking, like, it must be hard to dig. I went to the plot, I saw my father buried, and then I came back to the house, and I went to his closet, and I found a bow tie. I cut one of the wings of the bow tie off, and I wrote something on it. I think it was some kind of farewell to my father. I don't really remember what I wrote. And I buried it in the backyard. It was just some attraction to a ritual response to an impossible event.
Mom leaving the table. I'm out of the game. I don't know the people in your picture frame. If I ever loved you, oh no, no, it's a crying shame. If I ever loved you.
You Want It Darker, the last album, is saturated with thoughts of the end, of death. But Cohen's subjects were always there from the first, the big things, death, love, sex, God, and always undercut by that razory wit. And as a young man, Cohen wanted to be a writer above all, a poet. And he was following less in the path of Hank Williams or Bob Dylan in those days than he was in the path of Allen Ginsberg or Frank O'Hara.
His blood on my arm is warm as a bird. His heart in my hand is heavy as lead. His eyes through my eyes shine brighter than love. Oh, send out the raven ahead of the dove. His life.
That's Cohen reading at the 92nd Street Y in New York 50 years ago. But around that time, it came clear that he'd never make a real living as a writer. And surrounded in New York by talents and early friends like Lou Reed and Judy Collins and Patti Smith, he wrote the songs for his first record, which came out in 1967.
Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river.
Like the best poets, he was writing directly from his inner life and from the life all around him. If you grew up with him in Montreal, you also knew the places and the people in songs like Suzanne. And no one else seemed to have quite the same precision, the same irony.
And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China. And just when you mean to tell her that you have no love to give her, then she gets you on her wavelength and she lets the river answer that you've always. Travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know that she will trust you, for you've touched her perfect body with your. you're mine.
What Leonard Cohen found really difficult was performance, the stage. There was something about getting up on stage that he found almost false. He said that he felt like a chained parrot up there sometimes, and the stage fright could be paralyzing.
I'm scared enough as it is up here, and I think something's wrong every time you begin to applaud.
On one tour, he says he went through 3 bottles of wine a night before going on stage. Chateau Latour, in fact. It went so well with the music, he said. Still, the booze and the drugs didn't always really help with the anxiety.
I hope you bear with me. These songs are kind of, they become meditations for me, and sometimes I just don't get high on it. And I feel that I'm cheating you, so I'll try it again, okay? And if it doesn't work, I'll stop in the middle.
In Israel in 1972, he left the stage when he felt like the show just wasn't going well. He went back to the dressing room, and he dropped some acid. And then he heard the audience singing to him. It was really singing to him.
The audience had sensed that I was disappointed. I mean, how sweet? How sweet can an audience possibly be?
It was so, singing back to you.
They started singing Aveinu Sholom Aleichem. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm hearing this in the dressing room. They're singing it to me. And they mean to be singing it to me. So I go out and I start singing So Long As I Am.
That's one of his most famous songs about an ex-girlfriend. Meanwhile, the acid starts to kick in. He's hallucinating.
Won't you come over to the window, my little darling?
I see Marianne. She's right in front of me.
I'd like to try to read your
and I start crying. I turn around and band is crying too.
I was some kind of gypsy boy before I let you take me home. Come on now, so long, Marianne. It's time that we began to laugh and cry and cry and laugh.
And then it turned into something quite comic. The entire audience turned into one Jew.
Which is enough for anyone.
And this Jew was saying, "What else can you show me, kid? I've seen a lot of things, and this don't move the dial." The entire, skeptical side of our tradition manifested as an actual gigantic being judging me, hardly begins to describe the operation. I mean, the sense of invalidation and irrelevance that I felt was authentic because those feelings, I'm not unique in this respect, but those feelings have always circulated around my psyche, which is, where do you get to stand up and speak for what and who and, how deep is your experience? How significant is anything you have to say to anybody? I think it really invited me to deepen my practice. Like dig in deeper, whatever it was. Mm. Like take this thing a little bit more seriously,
the late Leonard Cohen. Cohen released 14 studio albums in his long career, along with another dozen-odd books of poetry and two novels. My conversation with him continues in a moment. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today, my conversation with the great songwriter, Leonard Cohen. We spoke in the summer of 2016 at his home in Los Angeles. Cohen was already very ill, but he was somehow bearing up with amazing determination, and he was really eager to talk. He died a couple of months later at the age of 82. Bob Dylan once said that Cohen's songs were like prayers, and many of them do lean heavily on Scripture, on the Psalms in particular. And his most famous song by far is called Hallelujah. Plenty of Cohen's fans have come to see him as a kind of quasi-religious figure, but when I spoke to him, Cohen was reluctant to overanalyze that religious aspect of his music. He didn't like the suggestion that he tried to give his work a spiritual uplift or heft.
Because I don't like to be identified with Jewish thought. In my own mind, you know, I know that I'm deeply conditioned by these. One of the great themes of Kabbalistic thought is the idea that the thrust of Jewish activity is the repair of God. God, in creating the world, dispersed itself. The creation is a catastrophe. There are pieces of him or her or it that are everywhere. And the specific task of the Jew is to repair the face of God. The prayers are to remind God that it was once a harmonious unity.
The birds, they sang at the break of day. Start again. Heard them say, don't dwell on what has passed away or what is yet to be. Yeah, the war, they will be fought again. The holy dove, she will be cut again, bought and sold and bought again. The dove is never free. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
Is your view of performance, especially in these last X years,
it's been
have a religious dimension that's self-conscious?
It's not self-conscious. You know, I only know that if I write enough verses and keep discarding the slogans, even the hip ones, mm-hmm. even the subtle ones, that something will emerge that represents. I've often said that the reason my writing is so slow is that I have to finish the verse before I discard it.
But as I understand it, also for a lot of songs that have, say, three or four verses that are on the recording or published on the page, there are 60 or 70 or 80 verses in there.
Some as many as that, but all with at least 10 or 20.
Like a lot of artists of his time, Cohen was a seeker. He dabbled in everything from Scientology to Dancing with the Hare Krishnas. But he stuck with spiritual life in a way that few of his peers ever did. He was serious. It was never a hobby. In fact, he spent long stretches at a Zen Buddhist monastery in the mountains outside of Los Angeles with a teacher named Joshu Sasaki Roshi, whose students lived in the most ascetic way possible. When I brought up Cohen's reputation as a ladies' man, he laughed and he talked instead about the thousands of nights and days he spent on a mountain just shoveling snow, cleaning, cooking, and meditating.
I was deeply associated with Roshi for over 40 years. I don't really know too much about Buddhism or what formal Buddhist training is. I only know Roshi's system, which I understand is eccentric. On its superficial level, it accomplishes what boot camp accomplishes, which is basically to get you to stop whining. It makes whining the least appropriate response to suffering.
Some years ago, Cohen came back from the Zen monastery only to discover that his accounts had been absolutely wiped out by his manager. He sued, but there was no getting around it. The money was gone, and there he was, well into his 60s, with nothing for his kids or for his retirement. So Cohen had no choice. He had to go back to work. He published a book of new poems for the first time in 20 years, and he went out on a tour that lasted more or less for 4 years. And there was a different feel to Cohen's work on stage after this monastic period. He was funnier. He was more animated, more lighthearted, and maybe for the first time, seemed really happy to be on stage.
I was talking with some of the guys. Some of the guys in this band are kind of, you know, over the hill. And they were talking about the various stages that a man goes through in relation to his allure to the opposite sex. You start off irresistible, and then you become resistible. Then you become transparent, not exactly invisible, but as if you're seen through old plastic. And then you actually do become invisible. And then, and this is the most amazing transformation, you become repulsive. But that's not the end of the story. After repulsive, you become acute. And that's where I am.
I caught one of those concerts at Radio City Music Hall, and I've got to say it was one of the best things I have ever seen in my entire life. Here was this guy, dressed in a suit and a fedora. Over and over again, he'd sink to his knees almost in devotion to the audience and to the songs themselves. I'd always admired Cohen's songs, but I'd never been quite swept away. The studio recordings especially sometimes seemed a little, I don't know, rinky-dink in their rendition. Too much synthesizer, not quite worthy of the songs. But that tour was a triumph. Leonard Cohen had an astonishing band now, and his voice was as deep as the ocean.
I'm just paying my rent every day in the Tower of Song. And I said to Hank Williams, how lonely does it get?
When we finally met, Cohen was suffering from these terrible health problems, cancer and excruciating back pain, and he was even allergic to most of the medicine that would alleviate the pain. All of those years spent meditating were coming in handy in an entirely new way.
I've had to white knuckle this thing. You know, fortunately, I have some training in, we could call it mind control. As a blessing, the mental activity is working just fine. I got most of my marbles, maybe more than I've had at other periods.
Right.
In a certain sense, this particular predicament is filled with many less distractions than at other periods of my life, and actually enables me to work with a little more concentration and continuity. The only thing that mitigates against full production is just the condition of my body, because there are times I just have to lie down.
Leonard, you have to say when you need a rest or...
No, I'm fine. It's you guys. Would you like something to eat?
He was incredibly solicitous. Instead of taking a break or asking us to come back another time, Leonard sent his assistant out to pick us all up some food at Fatburger down the street.
Oh, I think I got your onions. Did I get your onions, or that's you?
I think we all have onions.
Cohen told me he was still hearing the voice of God. And it was at that moment that somebody started up a leaf blower or some damn thing next door. But Cohen was saying that God sounded different now. Not that awful, incessant voice of judgment that he heard when he was younger.
Sometimes it's just like, you're losing too much weight now, man. You're dying, but you don't have to cooperate so enthusiastically with the process. You know, like, force yourself to have a sandwich or something, you know what I mean? You know, sometimes I hear it say, ignore me. Just get on with the things you have to do, you know. It's very compassionate at this stage, you know. I mean, more than any time in my life, I don't have that voice that says, you're f***ing up. That's a tremendous blessing. Tremendous blessing, you know. Really, you know. I'm ready to die. I hope it isn't uncomfortable. Spiritual things, Baruch Hashem, spiritual things have fallen into place for which I am deeply grateful.
To the very last, Leonard Cohen was working all the time, compulsively, focusing on what he could get done at home, writing, recording, collecting, finishing old poems. And to me, it seemed like almost a model of how to live your last days, if you can.
I like to tie up the strings. It's a cliche, but it's underestimated as an analgesic on all levels. Mm-hmm. Putting your house in order is one of the most, if you can do it, one of the most comforting activities. And the benefits of it are incalculable. There's a great deal of new material that I haven't sorted out. 50 or 60 unpublished poems. There are songs halfway through that are not bad. Listen to the hummingbird, whose wings you cannot see. Listen to the hummingbird. Don't listen to me. Listen to the butterfly, whose days but number three. Listen to the butterfly, don't listen to me, you know. Listen to the mind of God, which doesn't need to be. Listen to the mind of God, don't listen to me. It's halfway. I don't think I'll be able to finish those songs. And maybe I'll get a second wind, I don't know.
Became. I've got these excuses
they're tired and lame.
The late Leonard Cohen. I talked with him in the summer of 2016. His last album is You Want It Darker. And if you want to read the profile of Leonard Cohen that I published in the magazine, you can find it at newyorkerradio.org.
I'm out of the game. I'm leaving the table. I'm out of the game.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're going to close the show today with a holiday message from E.B. White. You probably remember E.B. White as the author of Stuart Little and Charlotte's Web, but White was also one of the New Yorker's earliest and most important contributors. He created the voice of the magazine along with James Thurber. His essays and stories and poems were published in the magazine for nearly six decades and won him accolades, including a Pulitzer Prize. This poem by E.B. White, and it doesn't have a title, was from December 1952. We've adapted it for the Radio Hour, and it was performed by Keegan-Michael Key, who's currently appearing in Steve Martin's play Meteor Shower on Broadway. Enjoy.
From this high midtown hall, undecked with boughs, unfortified with mistletoe, we send forth our tinseled greetings as of old. To friends, to readers, to strangers of many conditions in many places. Merry Christmas to uncertified accountants, to tellers who have made a mistake in addition, to grounded airline passengers, and to all those who can't eat clams. We greet with particular warmth people who wake and smell smoke. Merry Christmas to intellectuals and other despised minorities. Joy to the authors of books whose titles begin with the word how, as though they knew. Greetings to growers of gourds, to shearers of sheep, and to makers of change in the lonely underground booths. Merry Christmas to old men asleep in libraries! Merry Christmas to people who can't stay in the same room with a cat. Merry Christmas to people who plant trees in city streets. Merry Christmas to people who save prairie chickens from extinction. Greetings of a purely mechanical sort to machines that think, plus a sprig of artificial holly. Joyous Yule to Cadillac owners whose conduct is unworthy of their car. We send most particularly and most hopefully our greetings and our prayers to soldiers and guardsmen on land and sea and in the air. The young men doing the hardest things at the hardest time of life. To all such, Merry Christmas, blessings, and good luck. Merry Christmas to all who think they are in love but aren't sure. Greetings, too, to the inhabitants of other planets. See you soon! And last, we greet all skaters on small natural ponds at the edge of woods toward the end of afternoon. Merry Christmas, skaters. Merry Christmas to all, and to all, a good morrow.
That's a poem from E.B. White, published in The New Yorker in 1952. The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrato. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Rayfield, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Johnny Vince Evans, Terrence Bernardo, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.